Let me just hit the record. Okay, welcome. And Phyllis, to answer your question, we are on Chaf Beis, I'm an Aleph, that is 22a. So let's
Okay.
see.
I'm an Aleph. Okay.
Yeah, Chaf Beis, I'm an Aleph, 22a. And we're at the two dots, which is a quarter way down the Amud. Welcome, Marina, Zadie, Gloria, Andrew, Arthur, and Phyllis. And I'm joined with Toby here. And all right, we shall start. So the question we're going to deal with is as follows. Our Mishnah that we had previously, at the end of the Mishnah, it gave us one action that could have eight resulting lavin, eight resulting prohibitions, all in one action of plowing. Just to rehash, you don't need to look in Sifter Wanu, but if you do, it's on Chaf Aleph on the base 22, 21b. So on the top, it said, literally the first words, Yesh chorish telem echad b'chayv l'mishum shmona lavin. Someone could plow a field and violate eight different prohibitions. Hachorish b'shor when you, who, that's number one, plowing with an ox and a donkey together. Behemuk dashin, and they're of Hegesh, uklaim, and zarglaim bekarim, and they are moving around klaim. Ubishvius, it's during its sabbatical year. Ve'yom tov, and it's yontif. Ve'kohen, ve'nazir, ve'beis ha'tumah, and it's a kohen nazir, ve'beis ha'tumah. So we don't need to get into the details right now, but we counted eight different prohibitions that one could do all in one action. But the thing is, we started asking last time and got off on a bit of a tangent. Last time we began asking, well, if we can start at eight, why stop at eight? I can think of more than just eight prohibitions that one could theoretically violate at the same time as they are doing everything else. So the Gemara is going to continue by asking a series of questions of different possibilities of additional Isurim that could have been added on. Because usually what we tried answering last time was sometimes we say ton of a shear. You know, the Tana just wanted to give a few examples. He wasn't trying to give a thorough, comprehensive, exhaustive list of every single thing. But when you have a number like eight, clearly the goal of the mission was to try to outline how many, you know, what's the record that I could hit? How many Yisurim can I violate at the same time? It's like a trivia question. So why did the mission stop at eight when there's clearly more examples? What are these potential examples? Well, let's take a look in the Gemara. Again, this is Chaf Beis, I'm an Aleph 22a, and it is the two dots. So we see it says Simen Shnabi Shnaz. It's an acronym, basically to remind you of all the different rabbis who participate in this discussion. Here we go. So again, this is I don't know, 15 lines, if that helps at this point, 15 lines or so down. The two dots. The first word on the line is Losatsin. So Simen Shnavi Shnas. Masgivla Rav Hoshayim. Another prohibition could be, let's say he was plowing, not just where there may have been some graves in Beis HaTumah, but also we've learned about the Egla. I think we've talked about the Egla Arufa in passing previously. The Egla Arufa is when you have a dead body, somebody was murdered, but we don't know which city he was coming from at the time. I mean, we don't know who the murderer was. We presume what probably happened was this guy died because the people in the previous city didn't do enough achnasas orchim. They didn't care for him. They didn't provide him with provisions. And therefore, it's the responsibility we measure how far he is and who, whichever city he's closest to, we assume that's where he came from. And there's a whole ritual that the elders of the city need to do, where they say, we did not spill this blood. And they do the Eglah Arufa. They decapitate this young calf as part of the ritual. And so where the Eglah Arufa was slaughtered, that area is to a certain degree banned. It's off bounds, and you are not allowed to work that area. So let's say, in addition to everything in the Mishnah, he also decided to plow in an area that was not Esan. That would be a ninth prohibition that he violated. It says literally in the pasuk, you shall not work, you shall not plant that field area. So why didn't we add that one on? Now, just to brace you, there's going to be, I think, about seven suggestions. And I'm sure there probably are more, but the Gemara suffices by giving seven suggestions of what the Mishnah could have added to its list. So that was just number one. Suggestion number two. Maskiv la Rav Hananya, v'lichshov nami hamochik es Hashem bali chaso. Maybe what we could also conceive of a case where, in addition to all the assuming he was violating by plowing the field, he also erased God's name as he was plowing. Now, some of these cases, the Rishonim Acharonim have—they basically find it challenging to describe what the action would look like. Presumably, as he's plowing, he's also has an implement in his hand and is erasing God's name on something. I don't think it means that the name of God was etched into the ground somewhere, and by plowing it, he erased the name of God, possibly. But what it might be referring to is kind of like he swipes like a piece of paper or something on the side and erases God's name as he's going in the field with the plow. So again, conceivably,
I thought it was supposed to be the act of plowing. If he is doing another act while he's plowing, erasing God's name on, say, a piece of paper, that's not part of plowing.
Very good. So my grandfather asks, is that that's not inherently part of the act of plowing? So number one, I would say this is much closer than the issues in the Mishnah. Remember the Mishnah, we include in the list of Isurim being a Nazir or a Kohen in a Beis HaTumah, in a place that is spiritually impure. So there's nothing inherent to the act of plowing by virtue of a Kohen standing in an area where there is Tumah. But nonetheless, we count that in the eight.
But that's so what Kohen is doing, say, the plowing.
Right, but it's not inherent, though, to the act of plowing. That's just passively you being there is problematic. Meaning, for instance, if a Kohen all he did was take a nature walk through the cemetery, that also would be problematic. There's nothing intrinsically binding it to the act of plowing. He didn't have to do any plowing in order to violate that issue.
I agree.
So I would say this is actually closer, because as you're doing the act of plowing, a byproduct of it was also you actively erase the name of God. That, I would argue, is much closer because you're actually, it's part of the act. The Kohen doesn't need to do any action. Just being there is problematic.
But if the Kohen is plowing, then that's involved in the plowing. Not, it wouldn't apply to every Jew, but it would apply to Kohen. But I still can't conceive of how the act of plowing itself can possibly erase God's name. Circumstance.
Right, exactly. So a lot of the cases in the Gemara here are going to be difficult to conceptualize. And I think there's in the Rishonim, there's an Aruch HaNer that tries to make sense of it. So essentially, the case would seem to be that somehow there's like a piece of paper or parchment or whatever. Paper, yeah. And as you're moving by, you scrape off the name of God as you're doing it. Yeah. Alternatively, one could suggest, I haven't seen this, but I wouldn't be surprised someone suggests that someone etched the name of God into the ground, though that might be problematic also to do that to begin with, and destroy the name of God as he went through, potentially. But again, I'm just going to preface by saying, and Zadie, I appreciate you pointing this out, many of these cases are going to be difficult to conceptualize, and they're very far-fetched. But the reason we're able to ask about far-fetched cases like these is because the whole premise of our mission to begin with is far-fetched. The fact that, remember, what are all like, I'm a Kohen and a Nazir going through on Yontif, that's during Shvias, and it's a Beis HaTumah with a cow and with an ox. And, meaning, this whole case is a theoretical abstraction to begin with. Just for fun, academically almost. So to ask about a case which is very odd but possible is within the purview of this Mishnah, I would say. But again, I agree. Very weird. And brace yourself. There's going to be a bunch of those right now. But so buckle up. But okay, v'asarasim mihacham, where we know that one is not allowed to erase the name of God. V'avadatem eshemam, it says you shall destroy the names of the foreign gods. Lo sasun kein ladonai eloheichem. You shall not do that to Hashem, your God. So anything that you're supposed to do to the pagan idols, destroy them, erase them, that you shall not do to Hashem, your God. Suggestion number three of an additional isser someone could violate while plowing. Again, Zevi, is going to be similar difficulty to conceptualize. Maskivla Rabbi Avahu, v'lichshov nami hakotzeitz esbeherto v'asaras mehacha yishamir b'nega tzaras. Beheris, we've encountered recently, is a kind of tzaras. So I'm not sure why it specified that, why it had to specify Beheris per se, but okay. So basically, again, as you're doing the act of plowing, you also, again, are scraping against someone's arm and cutting off the Beheris that's on his skin. Sorry for being graphic. You excise it. So that also I can violate while doing a Maisa Harisha while plowing. So why isn't that included as well? Again, very far-fetched case, but that's what we're dealing with. Anything that could in theory happen halakhically, it's on the table for this Mishnah. So that's a third potential issur someone could violate. Number four, Maskivlo Abai, Velisho Nami, Hamiziach Hachoshe Me'al Ha'ifod, V'Hamaser Bade Aron. So this one might be a little bit easier to conceptualize. One is someone takes the, right, Zadie, let's say you get appointed to the Kohen Gadol, so you wouldn't be allowed to take the breastplate off of the ephod. The ephod is that like apron-looking thing that he wears that's attached to. There's a prohibition of removing it. So we're assuming that the Kohen is wearing the choshen that he took off and put it on himself after he loosened from the ephod. There's a discussion if it's just a one-time isser when you take it off of loosening it, or if it's a constant isser every second that you're wearing it, that's not no longer on the ephod, you are violating. Kind of like shatnez. Every moment you're wearing shatnez, you're violating the isser of shatnez passively. So that's one way to conceptualize it. The other way, again, to conceptualize it, similar to the other ones, while you're plowing, you brush by the ephod and you knock off the choshen. So that could be a possibility. The next one, though, is easier. Removing the poles from the aron and turning them into the implement that you're using to plow. You take the poles from the ark and you turn them into, you fashion them into a plow and use that to plow. That also could be an additional insert. Let's say my plow, right? We talk about the animals I was using. We talked about my personal status in the Mishnah, but we didn't talk about the actual plow that I'm using. Maybe the plow also could be made of something that's usher for me to use. So why didn't we take that into consideration? Unless you think that these are made up yisurim, v'asarasa mehavka, where do we know that one is not allowed to do this? Lo yasuru v'lo yisach ha-choshen. You shall not remove and you shall not loosen the choshen. That is a fourth suggestion that could have been added to our list in the Mishnah of Isur Violate when plowing. Suggestion number five out of seven. Maskivla Rav Ashi. I just saw you turn the art scroll. Next page in the art scroll. Thank you, Toby. I just saw you turn there. So anyone who's following, turn the art scroll now. Maskivla Rav Ashi. Velichshov Nami Hachoresh Ba'atze Ashera. And similarly, let's say the plow wasn't made up of the poles of the ark, but rather the opposite extreme. You took wood from an Asherah tree, from a tree that was used for Avodah Zarah, for idol worship, and you fashioned and repurposed it into a plow, and you used that plow. So Avodah Zarah is Aser Behana. There's two, you know, there's different levels of what is forbidden to us. For instance, generally, a pig is non-kosher, therefore I cannot eat pig. However, I'm allowed to benefit from pigs. So I think football, like an official football, is made out of pigskin. Is that correct? Or it's made out of some kind of leather. I think pigskin, some of them are made out of, or at least at some point they were. So would it be usser for me to use that football? No, it wouldn't, because pigs are not what we call usser behana. There's no prohibition for me to benefit generally I'm just not allowed to consume them. But certain things...
Well, so I can sell it.
What? Exactly. So you could sell it and make a profit off it. Or you could feed pig to your dog if you want. You could feed bacon to your dog if you want to do that. I don't know if it's healthy for a dog, but that's I think it's some dog foods. They have that in there. Some little bacon pieces. However,
you could use a pig's heart valve as a replacement for a heart valve.
Yeah, very good. Thank you, Zadie. I remember there was like some classic example where everyone made a whole fuss about. So yeah, Zadie, thank you. So Zadie, my grandfather is saying is, I think there's some controversy about using a using anatomy of a pig to replace something like a heart valve that must have been it. So there, it's completely mutter. Ah, you have like a hazard in your heart. What does that say about you? Okay, nothing. As Toby said, nothing. So certain things though are aser behana. For instance, basar b'chalav, actually. It says that one shall not eat osavat shall di b'chalav imo. It says it three times in the Torah. So what we learn from there is not just that it's usur for me to eat basar b'chalav, meat and milk together, but I'm not allowed to cook it, and I'm not allowed to benefit from it. So someone came over to me, a child of someone in our shul. I will not give any more details. He said, I work at this food joint, which is non-kosher, and they mix meat and milk together. Am I allowed to work there? And I said, well, the issue is basar b'chalav. You're not even allowed to cook basar b'chalav together. Now, the question is, since the meat you have might be non-kosher, inherently non-kosher already, maybe we say Inisr Chal Isr, but maybe not because Isr no stuff. So there's a whole discussion over there. But it was kind of funny, actually. Someone came over me literally with that question, can I cook Basar B'chalav? And I said, no, that's Beferish, why we have three, if it's mentioned three times. So I found that very funny. I don't think he was prepared
to put his job. On this line. What about the udder of a cow that has produced milk?
What if it
what comes out of the udder?
Of a cow. Yeah.
Can you benefit from the udder? Is it?
Can you eat the udder? If the cow is a Avodah Zarah, you're saying?
No, I'm saying.
Oh, that part udder, of the cow milk is, it, and meat. Is it basar b'chalav because milk comes out of that part of the body?
That's the whole conundrum in general. So the big question that comes up that Zadie and Henry that you're raising is the sugya of kechal, which I think some of you saw when I shared the pictures of Rav Tendler. He dissected an udder for us. So basically, Chazal and Hulin, they were concerned. Essentially, the milk in the udder, I believe, would actually be pariv while it's still in there, and you'd be allowed to actually eat it with the udder, but that would create lots of confusion and lead to different mistakes. So Chazal said it's usher to eat an udder, actually, lest you come to have it with the milk in there as well. And so there's ways to, I forgot, it's kind of like Jesse the Arab, and try to basically get rid of all the milk there so there's no concerns. But essentially, once the milk leaves the cow's udders, it assumes the status of dairy, of milk foods. But that's the whole conundrum. There, and I think I'm sure there's some good drush on it that I'm just not thinking about. But and that's a conundrum of basar b'chalav in general, because you know, you would think having a pig is worse, it's intrinsically non-kosher. But here you have two things, basar and chalav, they're both inherently kosher, but when mixed together, it's all of a sudden they fuse and all hell breaks loose. It's more usser than eating most other non-kosher categories. So that's what's very ironic. Okay, now why did I get into that? That was to get to Avodah Zarah. So Avodah Zarah is not just usur for meat to consume. Let's say they worship a cow in India. So it wouldn't just be usur for meat to eat the cow, but to benefit from the cow as well. And that's the question with the shetals that came from India. So because what they would do in India, supposedly, is that the women would grow wigs and they would bring their wigs to the temple as tribute. You know, you pay membership dues, you give donations to the shul every now and then, you help sponsor sfarim for the shul, whatever it might be. So these people, they bring their wigs. Now, the argument why women can wear wigs from India, look at this crazy culture we have, where we have to rely on women from India to give us hair. It's I'm not a woman, I shouldn't be criticizing this, but it's a funny thing. So is because the hair is not actually avodah zarah. There's no worship service where they use women's hair. It's just a monetary donation that they then sell so that they can bring money into their church or whatever they call it, in their temples. So since it's not being used for idolatrous purposes, it doesn't get the status of avizrayu avodah zarah. It's not an accessory to avodah zarah. But okay, point being is, let's say my plow was made of wood from an asherah tree, from a tree used for idolatry. So why couldn't that be another example in the Mishnah of something that I could have violated in addition to what was already mentioned? So that is the other question. And what do we say? Probably the next words, if I remember correctly. So that you shouldn't keep anything from that which is banned, and you shall not benefit from it. That was suggestion number five. Suggestion number six out of Toby.
Here in my Gemara, it said that four were further back. It was the breastplate and then the poles. Uh-huh. And then the next one is seven.
Oh.
Nothing was labeled six.
Oh, I have it. Well, we just did number five. Now we're doing number six.
Rav Ashi was number six.
Rav Ashi was number six. They might be counting.
They count the with the the case of the Badei Ha'aron and the Choshen. They counted as two in our scroll.
Ah, okay. I was thinking also they could have counted it from. They could have counted from Chaf Avim and Beis 21b from last week when Amar Le Ula Rav Nachman looking on Yishuv Zorei of Yom Tov, planting on Yom Tov. That was really the first question that we asked last week about planting on Yom.
The fourth and the fifth challenge starts with the Abaya
Zeh. Okay, so I guess I'm taking on Art Scroll. My biggest controversy is. Okay, so all right, but the way I'm counting it is we're up to number six. But however you want to count it, you can count it. Mask, as long as we're getting the same material, that's what matters. Maskul Rabina Elishov Nami Hakotit Ilanos Tovos. Also, let's say cutting down a fruit tree. When it's not allowed to cut down a fruit tree. And therefore, let's say I cut down a fruit tree that's much more conceivable, right, Zadie? Cutting down a fruit tree while I'm planting, it's a little bit easier to conceptualize. So again, it's still a little odd while planting. It was an uprooted tree. I don't know, you have this huge tractor that you're using, you knock it over, whatever it might be. So there too, that's another potential issue. What?
It could be a small sapling.
Yeah, oh, that's a good point. It could be a small sapling. That's
maybe 12 inches high.
Yeah, yeah. That, in Hakinami, that's a good point. I'm thinking of the trees that used to be in your front yard. You know, like those trees were, there's a whole operation. God. Yeah, I know.
Wow. Before they fell on the house, they were removed.
That's true, right. That's a good thing you guys addressed that. Okay, so that is another one. Great. Now, finally, suggestion number seven. This will be our final suggestion, and we're going to need to elaborate a little bit on it. So I know until now, you know, it's just sailing one after another. We now need to put our thinking hats on again, and we're going to get a little bit of a back and forth, a shock of the target here. But do not despair. We're almost at the Mishnah, so it could only get so bad, right? This is actually going to be very fascinating, so. Amar le Rabbi Zera le Rabbi Money. It's a great name, right? Lishrov Nami could go into Amar Shvua Shel Echrosh Biyomto. Let's say this guy, why don't we say Isser number 9 in the Mishnah, was in addition to me plowing it on Yom Tov, what if I took a Shvua, I took an oath that I will never plow anything on Yom Tov, on a holiday. That could easily be Isser number 9. That's very easy to conceptualize. So why didn't the Mishnah count that example? So what's funny is, unlike all the other questions where the Gemara kind of just left them as Sarach Ian, did the Gemara doesn't come back to address them, this one, the Gemara actually puts up a little bit of a fight and says, no, there's a reason it wasn't counted in the Mishnah. Hasam lo kachal shvua mushbava ome merit sinayu. Well, because that shvua, that oath, would not be chal. It couldn't take effect. Why? If God already told me that I'm not allowed to work my field on Yom Tov, I can't make a shvua to not work on Yom Tov because I'm already mushpa, I'm already bound by the ultimate oath, by the covenant that I have with God. So to make an oath, I'm not going to steal, I'm not going to murder. That oath doesn't mean anything because God already commanded me. I'm already sworn allegiance to God in general to keep his Torah. So I can only make an oath on something that I'm not otherwise obligated by Hashem to do. So that's how we reject it. However, we're going to learn about something called an Isser Kolel here. Now, Isser Kolel doesn't mean an Isser to sit and learn in Kolel, as much as modern Orthodox people would love to hear that. but it's something else, as you'll see momentarily. Amarle, Gagon de Amar. Someone has to make that joke before me. Like someone for sure has had to make that. All right. Amarle, Gagon de Amar Shrua Shlo Echrosh Bein Bechol Bein Beyom Tov Demigu de Chalale Shrua Bechol Chalale Nami Beyom Tov. What's the case here? It's Kolel. What does it mean? It's Kolel. I take an oath that in general, I'm not going to plow my field. And subsumed within that statement, I am saying I'm not plowing on weekdays nor on Yom Tov. So since the Shvua takes effect on the days that I am allowed to work my field on weekdays, we would say, Agav, it also includes Yom Tov and presumably Shabbos as well. Even though I couldn't take a solitary oath exclusive to Shabbos or Yom Tov, which I'm already aser, since I can aser myself, I can prohibit myself to plow on weekdays, along with it, a corollary includes that I can't plow on Shabbos and Yom Tov. Therefore, if I do plow on Shabbos and Yom Tov, I would violate not only the iser of Chil Shabbos and Chil Yom Tov, but also of breaking my Shvua. So why couldn't Shua be included in our Mishnah then? Well, it could have been included in our Mishnah. Why wasn't it? Meaning the Isa B'Sheila Lokatani. Things that one could ask a rabbi to annul for him, to ask Talmud Chacham to annul, those things the Mishnah was not counting. So we know, we do Kol Nidre, we do Hataras Nedarim for Rosh Hashanah. So since a neder is something that is not it's subject to change. I can ask my neder to be revoked. I go to a chacham. Now the circumstance of what could be revoked, when could it be revoked, details beyond the scope of our discussion here. We can learn nedarim another time. But since it's subject to change, the Mishnah didn't count it. Velo, bare hekdesh. What do you mean? We have hekdesh in our Mishnah. Hekdesh is something that could be revoked, designation of hekdesh. But what kind of hekdesh are we talking about in our Mishnah? The bechor, something, a bechor, which is automatically designated as hekdesh from the moment that it's born. It's something that's intrinsically hekdesh. Bahari nazir. But what about nazir? A nazir is, again, that's a prime example of where I accept an oath of nazirus to become a nazir. And then I go to the rabbi and like, yeah, you know, I was feeling really frum the other day and I thought it'd be really cool. And then I realized being a nazir was not a great idea. So being a nazir also is something that can be revoked. Yet it's mentioned in our Mishnah. So clearly our Mishnah counts different prohibitions that are based on things that I accept upon myself and can be revoked. So rather, what kind of nazir are we talking about? But Nazir Shimshon. A Nazir Shimshon is a special kind of category, again, that somebody is basically born with. Like Shimshon. Shimshon was born and sworn into Nazirus right away. Nazir Shimshon, bar it's Muy Levis.
Because of his mother.
Yeah.
So couldn't the mother know it?
I don't know, think she had the power to do it. That's could her his mother said she's the one who created it. I'm not aware of that being a way out, but it seems only fair. Toby asked if Shimshon's mother was the one who kind of made the deal to be turned into a Nazir, could she have the power to revoke it? I don't think she had the power, but...
I mean, yeah. Her husband would have the power to
revoke it. Oh, interesting. Would her husband have had power to revoke it? Well, the thing is, once a husband is aware of his wife making a neder. And this is interesting because usually when a woman makes a neder, she's making it on herself. Here, it's such a fascinating and weird case because she's kind of doing it for her child. Generally, the halacha is that a woman...
Well, not to be an ozer, but to give him to the temple.
Well, that's right, but that's not an oath at that point. That's, I don't know what that is. Yeah, it's a good question.
Did she accept it, or did just God told her this is the way it was going to be?
Yeah, you know, we need to look into that more because there seems to have been like almost a deal. I think it was like a deal.
If you give me a child, I will bring
it. Right, since so you know, right.
That's about.
All right, it's a good question.
There's a note in the art scroll that Rivan rejects. He says the father can indeed annul the Nazareth vow made for the son.
Let's take a look at the Rivan. Nazir Shimshon Bar Tmei LeMeisim. Okay, so first the question is, I see. Let's see. Nazir Shimshon. I de malach kibul nazir salav. It's through a malach. Dahu elo she'ela. The tzivoy shela malahu. There's the answer to your question. Thank you for noting the Rivan over there. So the Rivan says that this was Naziros that actually we don't view it as being accepted by her. It was accepted via an angel on behalf of God. So no one could annul something that God has decreed. I know Toby's like, what do you mean? We finally see there's agency on the woman's part here in halacha.
And she was told that's the way it is.
And that's what that's the point that the Rivan is making, that that it was from an angel that came by, and therefore it's irrevocable. Yes, I see the Rivan you're referencing. Very good. Very good. So let's, so the question is, though, the category, you look in the Mishnah's Nazir, it talks about this, the Nazir Shimshon has its perks, even though you are basically a Nazir for life, and it's irrevocable. Nonetheless, Nazir Shimshon Bar Tmei LeMeisivu. You ever wonder if Shimshon was a Nazir, why was he allowed to fight the Plishtim and kill all of them? He's becoming Tamei Meis. A Nazir is not allowed to become in contact with the dead. But what do you know? That happens to be the special, unique category of Nazir Shimshon permits one to come in contact with the dead. How convenient, right? Or, I mean, we dafka learn from the story. So, you know, it has its ups and downs, its positives and drawbacks. So if so, okay, we're at a dead end over here. It seems that the Mishnah is okay, because the Mishnah is talking about the Nazir. It's an Isser for a Nazir to walk through a Beis HaTumah. Yet, if it's a Nazir Shimshon, he would be allowed to walk through a Beis HaTumah. So we're back to the drawing board. If so, why didn't our Mishnah, again, count the case where I take an oath? Where I take an oath that I will not plow the field. Ella haitana iser kolel leisle. Rather, our Tana does not acknowledge that there is an iser kolel can work. What does that mean? What it means is when I take an oath that I will not plow a field during the week and on Yom Tov, even though it would take effect in theory during the weekdays, it would not also, by dint of taking effect on weekdays, also take effect on the Yom Tovim. Therefore, we cannot ask, why did the Mishnah include a case of someone who swears that he will not work on Yom Tov? Because this Tana, there's no such kind of oath that they can take that would be effective to prohibit them from working at Yom Tov, because they're already mushba va'omei mehar Sinai. They are already committed from the covenant that we made with God at Mount Sinai. And okay, so that brings us to a few lines before the end of the Mishnah. Let's get to the end. In a few lines before the end of the Mishnah, we're going to talk about an interesting case of klayim. Generally, klayim is when you have two animals, like the shor v'chamor, the ox and the donkey, working together. However, this is going to be a very weird case of klayim. So here's what happens. One gives an animal to be sacrificed in the temple. It sustains a wound, a mum, that would disqualify it. So what he does is he gives money to the temple to purchase back the animal. And the animal is in this liminal stage where, on the one hand, one is allowed to eat it. You look at Rash Rivan, he goes through it. One is allowed to eat it. But on the other hand, it still retains a certain degree of kedusha, residual kedusha. Then one's not allowed to, if it's like a sheep, you're not allowed to shear it. And you're not allowed to work it either. So it kind of has a status of both being a mundane animal and a sanctified animal, both at the same time. What's interesting about that? So you look here, Amar Rabbi Hoshaya, Amar Bia Shor, Psulei Hamukdashim, Loke Shnayim. So one who will mate a shor with, and here it's not even with another animal. It could just be literally with an other cow, with its own breed. Nonetheless, you will violate two Isurim. What are the two Isurim? So Rivan points it out. The two Isurim are, also so what we have, what we're dealing with here, is that it basically the animal is considered to be inherently klein, meaning you're not allowed to work an ox and a donkey together. So to work this animal, which is a mixture of hektish and a mixture of chulin, of sanctified and non-sanctified, is actually, it intrinsically is klein. Crazy, right? Rivan actually writes all the way at the end, right before the mission, he says, "Lo shemaya ashmati rayami melam tefulin ukachu klein zeh b'zeh udavar teimah." He's like, it's a wonderment. Like, what is this idea that an animal can be intrinsically klein because it's partially chulin, partially kachim at the same time? Such a weird idea. And so, and you look, by the way, you look at the next case, the final case, the second one. It's Amar Rabbi Yitzchak Hamanik B'Shor P'sulei Hamukdashim Loka, one who just, you know, you put a load on it and you, it's a donkey and you get to walk from one place to another. Well, not a donkey, here it's an ox. Shari Guf Echad Hu, it's one body physically, but V'Asu Akasu K'shnei Gufim. The Psukim, the Torah, considers it, it categorizes it as if it carries both a classification of being consecrated and non-consecrated at the same time. Wow, what a crazy case. And even the Rivan expressed some reservations about it. That's what it says. That brings us to the Mishnah. So good. Let me give you a quick intro right here. Let me ask you a question. We'll end before 8. So Zilberstein has a question. The question is, let's say you come down good at Shalom, God willing, this will never happen. And let's say, I don't know what it says on the elevator. It says, go to the office if you want information whenever I'm in there. I'm like, okay. But let's say it says on the elevator, no more than 200 pounds. Probably wouldn't say, let's say 400 pounds. No more than 400 pounds in this elevator. And I go in, it breaks while I'm in there. Thank God I'm not harmed. But it turned out I went in with a bunch of friends and collectively we weighed 401. So am I responsible to compensate the building for breaking the elevator, or could I respond and say, well, what do you mean? Obviously, when it says 400, it's a grace measurement, meaning it's an approximation. Any company, right? I'm sure Matt and all the people who are working with Rachel and all the people working on the building here, if they're going to say 400 pounds maximum in the elevator, it doesn't mean 401, all of a sudden it's going to snap on you. It's an approximation, but they're going to leave a grace, not grace period. But
buffer.
What was that?
Buffer.
A buffer, thank you. They're going to leave a huge buffer between what the actual capacity is and what they write on there. So the defendants are claiming, well, what do you mean? And by the way, I'll make the question, he doesn't say this, but I'll make the question stronger. Let's say, right, personal injury attorney Toby, let's say the people in the elevator were actually harmed in the process. So would they be able to sue the owners of the building for compensation, restitution for being harmed in a broken elevator? Could the owner of the building say, well, it said 400, you were 401, too bad? So that's the question where Zilberstein asks, and we're going to look at a Mishnah now that might give us some insight onto that. negligent supervision of elevator. Okay. Yeah. Hopefully, as I said, hopefully it should never happen here. I'm always scared to, I avoid using elevator if I can, not just for health reasons, but also because, you know, when I went to get my shot at my first shot for the vaccine at Stanford Hospital, no, actually, it was my follow-up one. I got into the elevator and it was like stuck for like 30 seconds. And I'm like, maybe it just takes a while. Maybe it just takes a while. And then I'm like, oh no, it's not opening. My God, get me out. So finally, like I kept pressing buttons and then like all of a sudden it started moving to a different floor and then opened up and I got on this floor. No one was around. I went down the stairs and then the woman was like, oh, it's okay. Don't worry. This elevator here is working. You can go. I said, no, I'm taking the stairs. No more elevators at Stanford Hospital for me. But don't worry. It was in like one of the older wings, not in the new part. The new building there, the main one. That's nice. And the thank God the.
That's not where they get shots.
No. Shots, yeah, I advise if you can take the stairs in that building, I would take the stairs. Now the elevators are really old, and I was genuinely scared for my life. Okay, so again, hopefully it's all theoretical. So the mission goes as follows. And again, I know our Mishnah crap on Fridays, Gloria, Marina, and here from Phyllis, possibly. I know you guys learned this with me recently. So our Mishnah crowd who is on with us. Kama Malkin Oso, how much Malkus do we give? Now you would think we would ask this question much earlier. We finally talk about all the cases that incur Malkus, but what does Malkus actually look like? So we know a little bit already because we went to the Gemara, and I've provided things from the commentaries, but in the Mishnayos, the Mishnah never told us what Malkus actually looks like when it is meted out. How do we administer it? Kama Malkusim, how many Malkus does one get? So we say, 40 minus 1. Can we do math? That's 39. Shnemar, where do we see that in the Pasuk? The Mispar Arbaim. So the Mispar Arbaim is within the number of 40. What's within the number of 40? Around that? 39. So Minai, Shusamach Arbaim, where do we know? Has to be right next to 40. Right. Once there's a gear set change I see here, actually. To change the gear, so but sorry, right? It says push who she's that toes, sorry, yos sukam shr button. Okay, interesting. Okay, there's a bit of, not so, okay. So some of was suk. Okay, interesting. Okay, don't worry about that. So Rabbi Hudomer are buying shlemos who? No, like the pusik sounds. It says 40. You get 40. The Hechan Huloka, and now where does the 40th extra one take place? Esayisera Bein Ketefa. So, Hechan Huloka is Esayisera Bein Ketefa. It's between the shoulders. We'll talk about next week where the actual lashes are given. Ein Omdin Oso El B'Makas Ruiz Eshtalish. But remember, the Tanakhama holds that when one gets 39, not just because of the reading of the Pasuk, but also we derived that we split Makos into three, 1/3 on the front, 2/3 on the back. So 39 could split into 13, 13, 13. 40 is not divisible by three. Amdu lekabel arbayim. So let's say we assess that someone could receive 40 lashes or about or 39. Ulaka miksas, returning page. So amshin yofel lekabel arbayim, hotter. So let's say halfway through the lashes, they realize this guy is not going to make it to 39. So then they only go so far as he can handle, and they don't make up for it later. Amdu lekabel shmona esrei, in the opposite case, let's say they assess he could only handle 18. Mishalaka amshiyahu lekabel arbayim, and in the middle, like, oh, this guy can handle a lot more than 18. He was just pretending to be a baby. And then putter. Still, if we already established 18, we don't take any risks. We stop at 18, and that's it. Now, the question is, so where do we see from this Mishnah an answer to our question about the elevator? Anyone know? The answer is not easy to figure out. I wasn't expecting anyone to figure it out. I probably would not have known had I not been prompted by reading this. So Rav Zilberstein quotes the Rambam. The Rambam is not satisfied with the number 39, meaning it says 40 in the Pasuk. Where do we get 39 from? So Rambam says, what's the svara? What's the reason behind 39? Sha'afilu Habari b'yoser makanasu shloshim v'teisha. Why do we whack somebody only 39 if you can handle more? Kidei shem yosifu lo achas. That way, really, a person is supposed to get 40. But we don't want to give him 41 because then it's bal tosif there, and then I'm doing more than I'm permitted to do. So what do? We say we do 39 max. So if you miscount and you give him one additional one, nitsa shlo hiko elar by meruyas. Worst case scenario, you gave him the 40 that he was within your right for you to give him anyway. We don't want you to, so we err to the side of caution. We don't want you to assess him for 40 and give him 41, which is one more than one's allowed to give. But therefore, we err to the side of caution and we say maximum 39 because maybe it'll come to 40. So this already sounds a little bit like our elevator case over here, right? That we aim for 400 pounds and not 500 so that there's a huge buffer. So what he suggests, what Zilberstein suggests, is, you know, in general, when we assess, that's what we do. Even the doctors who are there, it's EF Shalitzamtin. You know, no one's there like, he can handle 39, but if we give him 40, he's going to die. You know, if it's like that close, you shouldn't be giving him 39 either. Basically, we're not going to read through the whole thing. We're not going to read through any of it. What Silverstein says is that we see when we give assessments, when we evaluate things, give a number, it's understood that we are leaving ourselves a buffer, or what's that called in statistics? We leave a
margin of error.
Thank you, Zadie. That's what I was looking for. We leave a margin of error. I took statistics, but I can't remember the basic terms for it. So we leave a margin of error that way. So what the answer is, the people in the elevator are not guilty because it's self-understood that you can go a few pounds over. It's thinking about also like when you're driving, I've never had a police officer pull me if it's 50 miles per hour. Oh, you were going 53 miles per hour. No, what it means is 50 miles. Maybe I'm misunderstanding things when I'm like on High Ridge or wherever I am, versus 40 or whatever it is. But when it says 50, you're like, yeah, sure, it's something. It was precisely at 50. You're allowed to go a few miles over the speed limit. They're not going to pull you over for that. Unless, yeah, they're not going to do it.
Depends on the mood.
Right. It depends on the mood. Right. Some would say it depends on the race, but we're not going to go there. No, I'm just kidding. We're not going to get into politics. So now the question, though, he doesn't address is what I'm wondering is, okay, I understand the folks in the elevator are not obligated to pay the owner of the building, but if they had they gotten injured, would the owner of the building have a strong enough of a claim to at least exonerate him from having to provide restitution? So he doesn't really address that. And I'd love to get an answer to it. So maybe a future share at a future point someday down the line. All right. Shkoch, everyone. Thank you for logging on. Please just stay on one moment. Our CM, I will send out an email, God willing, as we get closer. But our CM will be, God willing, Sunday, December 12th at 10:30 a.m., a nice brunch. I want to thank Mitchell Bell and Phyllis Shapiro, who will be working on organizing the food aspect. A number of you, I know Marina, Gloria, Toby, and others have reached out about co-sponsoring. So any way that anyone wants to be involved, I also want to see if we can I don't want to exclude anyone. So I want to include people. If you have any thoughts you want to share for literally a 2-minute slot during the program, just about how your learning experience, you can let me know. And I'm happy to give everyone like a 2-minute slot or so just to share any brief remarks that they have to mark the occasion. You can come, you can invite family to come, close friends that you want to celebrate this accomplishment are welcome to come. And God willing, a month beforehand, we'll have the event on the shul website. I'll send out a form where you could sign up to RSVP for it. And I'm very excited. It was a huge accomplishment. And I'm looking forward to celebrating with all of you. Best Hashem. Okay. And
Henry, how was the drive?
All right.
Thank you.
Good drive was fine. I did it over 2 days. It worked out. It worked out.
Oh, you're in Chicago now, Henry.
I am
B-H-Y-Y.
Wow. All right. Well, we're going to miss you, Henry. And, you know, also everyone just in general should I visited Judd Love. He's a member of our Shear. He's been catching up on the video still. He's with us just when he's able to. So just remember to check in on Judd Love. You know, he could use the well wishes. Anyone who could visit. Just looking out for members of our Chabura here, okay?
Sure.
All right. For those who come on the Monday night class, it's only on Zoom. It's at, I need to check the time myself. I think we did 7:30. Me and two of my colleagues were going to have a conversation about Kirov. So it'll be on Zoom at same login information as you just got onto this, but not in person, only on Zoom. All right. Take care. Have a good night and a good show.
Thank you, Rabbi.